I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Race reality seems to come in paradoxes. What the poet Amiri Baraka called the changing same. President Obama this week led the 50-year celebration of the Selma breakthrough into voting rights. And still we're fixed on the regress into Jim Crow justice. And not just in Ferguson, Missouri, where the town criminalized black behavior down to jaywalking and made money on it. Racial disadvantage runs deep countrywide, especially in housing and hiring. Most black children grow up in problem neighborhoods. 95% of white kids don't. But then look at fashion, sports, and music, and explain why hip-hop culture, out of the black kids' imagination, rules the waves. We're asking our guest, the sociologist Orlando Patterson, his own question. What is the truly immutable force in the inequality and alienation of black and white? The Cultural Matrix is the title of his book, which sets out to capture not just the vital numbers, but the feel, the future, the direction of black and white, separate and together, and also his own sharp takes on the underlying questions, past nurture and nature to culture and institutions, white racism, black performance, all of them at a teaching moment that feels raw and ripe for rethinking. We begin, though, with the President of the United States in high Obama speeching, preaching style last Sunday, defining an all-American moment in Selma from 1965. And then he went out of his way to assert that the high triumph of Selma had not been eclipsed by the rampant racism that turned up in the Justice Department's review of the Ferguson police.
You know, just this week I was asked whether I thought the Department of Justice's Ferguson report shows that, with respect to race, little has changed in this country. And I understood the question. The report's narrative was sadly familiar. It evoked the kind of abuse and disregard for citizens that spawned the civil rights movement. But I rejected the notion that nothing's changed. What happened in Ferguson may not be unique, but it's no longer endemic. It's no longer sanctioned by law or by custom. And before the civil rights movement, it most surely was.
Professor Orlando Patterson, first, so good to be reading you in detail again at length and making radio with you. Did not the president step right into one of the key arguments in and around your book, this whole matter of embedded racism that shows up in local police practice? And the president knows there are many, many Fergusons. Would you have edited him on that point, or would you have agreed with him on the matter of endemic racism?
I would have agreed with him at 100%.
That it's not endemic?
Not in the way it used to be, as he pointed out very carefully, pre-civil rights. I've been living here for 40 years, and I can tell you it's a very different society from the society I came to in 1970. I think he's right, and I think it's very important, he didn't say this, that we recognize the problems that persist, and there are problems that we're going to talk about, but it's equally important that we don't overreact right now, and I see a real danger of that happening.
Overreacting to Ferguson, meaning what?
Meaning that Ferguson refers to a specific problem, a very serious problem, having to do with failure of police work, having to do with institutional failure in the way in which we train police, in the way in which the police relates to the community, and in particular, the way in which the police relates to black youth. There is a chronic problem there, and that's endemic, and that's serious, and that has to change. But that's not America. That's not the whole of America. That's one segment of America. And it is a huge problem. And it's a problem which spills over to many other blacks. Because when the police starts to identify all blacks with a particular segment of a black population, we have a problem. So I'm absolutely of the view that we have a serious problem there. But let us be clear that we do not sort of generalize this to the whole society and to the way in which the society has changed,
but
which is really quite dramatic.
Can we just be sure we recognize symptoms for their underlying implications? I mean, there's an old scorecard here, and you know it too well, on between blaming institutions and underlying white racism and then blaming black culture as alternative roots of the situation. I think a lot of people, and maybe me too, take Ferguson as a reminder of the deep underlying problem. But you've diversified the whole count, and I want you to spell out how you did it.
Well, there's no such thing as black culture, for one thing. I mean, one of the points we strongly emphasize in this book is the heterogeneity of the black experience in America. This is a very rich cultural diversity among black Americans. 80% of black Americans subscribe to a range of cultures. Some of them are about 20, 25, almost 30% in some areas, are middle class. And their culture is just an adapted version of mainstream American middle class culture. The black working class, again, has a vernacular culture which has contributed so much to the broader society. They are among the most law-abiding, God-fearing group and church-attending group in this nation. What you do have is a particular group of younger people, disconnected, who have what is variously called a street culture, what have you, which is a problem. But it's important that we don't generalize from that. But this street culture is real, and it accounts for some of the problems we face here. Because one of the here's the real sad irony of this situation. In the inner cities, we have a situation in which the 80% of law-abiding people face a real problem with the disconnected, those who are not in school, not in work, and have a real problem with authority. And in fact, which creates problems for the broader society. And this broader society, this 80% of the population, actually needs the police to come in and protect them. Instead, what we have is a police force which focuses on this 20%, which creates the problem, generalizes this to the entire black population, sees themselves as an occupying force in the black community. And instead of protecting and helping to protect the black community, they, in fact, are abusing
the entire
community.
Whatever happened to community policing?
Well, that's
caught on here for a while.
Yeah, well, that's part of the institutional failure, which is the major problem which we should be focusing on. That is that the police force sees itself now as responding to crime. They sit in their police cruisers and they respond to 911 calls. They do not do what the police should be doing, which they should be out there in the streets, interacting with the community, protecting the community. Instead, they see themselves as, number one, either just responding to 911 calls or, in fact, as an occupying force, which is getting the bad boys, which they then generalize to all black youth. And that is the problem. It's chronic, it's serious, and it needs to be fixed.
I want to come back to the largest frame of this book and the argument around it. Is it fair to say that the bumper sticker of your book could be Moynihan was right? Moynihan being Pat, later the senator from New York, 50 years ago, he wrote a kind of bureaucrat's memo for the Labor Department and Lyndon Johnson that said the black family was sinking in a tangle of pathologies. And he got discounted for years for seeming to blame the victim. Here, your book keeps coming back, though, to his themes of kids missing their fathers and isolated neighborhoods missing hope.
Yeah, it's complicated. I don't think that's the central point of the book, but let me say that it is one of the issues we address. There's no doubt that we have a problem of a significant number, not the majority. We're back to the 20% again of youth who, as a result of the single-parent situation, are just not being brought up. I mean, it's partly a problem of poverty, and is not exclusively just the single parenting or the single mother family, because a single woman is quite capable of bringing up a child quite competently. The problem is, of course, the amount of time you have for bringing up your kids. If you have to do two jobs to survive at minimum wage. You're spending 15 hours working, you come home, you're exhausted. I mean, what this means, in fact, is that between 3 o'clock when school is over and 8 o'clock when she comes home exhausted. No one is looking after the kids. And for boys, especially boys in their early teens who need supervision and attention, that's a problem. Mm. So it's as much an economic problem as a cultural one. In fact, it's more an economic problem than a cultural one. But whatever its source, the point is that to the degree that this has been expanding and growing, it is problematic. But it is not a problem for the entire black community. It's a problem in the sense that a significant number of boys, less so girls, although it's somewhat problematic for girls too, but essentially boys are in fact not being brought up because their parents do not have the resources, the time to bring them up.
Can I bring you back to two other important sort of institutional pieces of this story in your book? You say that mass incarceration is a disaster and that the war on drugs has got to go.
Yeah.
Spell it out.
Two more institutional problems in this country. Mass incarceration is a disgrace. It's an obscenity that this country, which claims to be the leader of the free world, is incarcerating more of its people than any other country in the history of the world. I mean, it was an overreaction. It was a problem that got completely out of hand, and it's counterproductive in the sense that it's creating criminals. How we got into this is a long story. It's also a complicated one. It's ironical that it was a liberal politician who instituted it. But whatever the origins,
meaning
Rockefeller.
Nelson. Okay. Nelson Rockefeller.
Yeah. With, ironically, the urging of people in the liberal community, including black leadership, who needed some relief from the crisis they were facing as a result of the drug epidemic in the late 70s and 80s. But that then got completely out of hand, and this should never happen. Most of these people should have been in rehabilitation, not in prison. That is just a disaster. The war of drugs has been a complete failure, and the prison incarceration system is not just a failure, but it's been a disaster, and it creates the problem it's supposed to be solving.
Orlando Patterson is our guest. The Cultural Matrix is his book, Understanding Black Youth. Coming up, a closer reading of Ferguson, Missouri, as the story of what we're dealing with. With the writer Jelani Cobb, who was there for The New Yorker. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source on the Racial Matrix with Orlando Patterson. The Cultural Matrix is the title of his book. We're talking about heterogeneous, interactive cultures, white and black, in families, in banks, in officialdom. We're talking about imbalances of power and what keeps them that way. Listen again to President Obama in Selma, Alabama, last Sunday, drawing lessons from Ferguson, Missouri.
Of course, a more common mistake is to suggest that Ferguson is an isolated incident, that racism is banished, that the work that drew men and women to Selma is now complete, and that whatever racial tensions remain are a consequence of those seeking to play the race card for their own purposes. We don't need a Ferguson report to know that's not true. We just need to open our eyes and our ears and our hearts to know that this nation's racial history still casts its long shadow upon us.
Jelani Cobb is professor of history at the University of Connecticut. He's a regular contributor to The New Yorker. He covered Ferguson for the magazine last summer, and he wrote about it again last week after the Justice Department's report on the Ferguson standard of predatory police policy with black people. Welcome, Professor Cobb. Would you review the president's thinking there, and then Professor Patterson's cultural matrix?
Well, thank you for having me first. And it was very interesting to have Ferguson and the Ferguson report come down so quickly and in such close proximity to the speech that the president was due to give in Selma. And so I'll just say one thing from the outset. When you look at the conversations that people had around Ferguson, there was a stark kind of disparity between the dialogue that was being had outside of Ferguson by people in the media, people who were informed by the media, the general din and clatter of American racial debate. And then the conversation that was happening among people who were in Ferguson. And so even, this was apparent even when I first got there. I got there the first week after Michael Brown's death, the week of his death, I should say. And when you talk to people there, they would talk about the incident. They would talk about the fact that his body had been left in the street for 4.5 hours, that people had been traumatized by this and so on. But they would pivot. They would pivot away, where a lot of people outside got caught up in the details of whether this was a young man who had stolen something, whether this was a young man who was a gentle giant or, in fact, a menacing thug, and this kind of Rorschach conversation about who he was that we got bogged down in. People who were there tended to pivot away from those kind of details to talk about more specifically the context in which he died. And so they would say, Michael Brown is an example of a much bigger problem.
Right.
And so by the time people got into this debate, I think it was kind of very well, most notably seen when Joe Scarborough from Morning Joe went into a tirade about what an imperfect example people had chosen to rally around in Michael Brown. But it completely missed the point. The people there were saying that even if everything Darren Wilson said was true, which is hard to believe, but if everything he said is true, that Michael Brown went for his weapon, that Michael Brown struck him, that he was dazed and he was concerned that he'd pass out, all these details about why he felt it necessary to fatally shoot him, if those things were true, the police by that point had so little moral authority in that community that simply no one would believe anything they had to say.
Right.
And I think that was a reality that people couldn't really understand until the Ferguson report came from the Department of Justice. So it seems contradictory to some people that they did not find enough evidence to charge Darren Wilson, but they did find this huge systemic problem with the Ferguson PD. That would be contradictory to anyone except the people who actually lived there.
Right. Well, it also marked a pivot, to mix metaphors here, but in the zeitgeist in general. I would call it the Ta-Nehisi Coates turn in public thinking about race in general. But it follows on Michelle Alexander's indictment of the new Jim Crow. Also, more and more impatience with mass incarceration, but with voting restrictions, job discrimination. It seems to me that the Coates view, to go back, sort of broke out in on the Atlantic cover last year. And the line basically was that there's a persistent racism, an ingrained white supremacy that runs through all of American life in theory and in practice. And as one reader, I have to say, once you've inhaled that evidence and thought seriously about it, it's hard to shake. That the underlying embedded racism is the problem.
Right. I mean, I think Ta-Nehisi can speak for himself, but I think that it's probably true that there's abundant evidence of this. So what we've engaged in is a kind of sly reversal of cause and effect. And we see it in lots of places. Most notably, just in kind of a small instance of it, was this week when we saw the uproar about the young men at the University of Oklahoma who were chanting, obscene, racial epithets and so on, and making reference to lynching. And then on television, again on Morning Joe, I don't know why I'm beating up on them so much today right now, but Mika Brzezinski made the point that they were influenced by rap. And that they were doing these, making these racist statements because rap has been so profligate in the use of the so-called N-word. And it was really bizarre because the use of that term by no means is correlated to its existence in hip-hop culture. It's not like people ever needed the permission of rappers to use that word. It's not like that song doesn't antedate the existence of hip hop.
Right.
And so
John Stewart did a very effective number on precisely that theme.
Right. And so what we find here is this, to make the bigger point, we find certain problems, within the black community. And it's much easier to say that this is a self-inflicted wound. We live in a society, and it's not particularly racial. We live in a society where we have great difficulty dealing with American culpability, period. Racism, as it pertains to black people and slavery and the legacy of Jim Crow, is just our most glaring and notable domestic example of it. But we're not really eager to talk about, you know, what we've done in foreign policy or what we've done economically around the world either.
No, well said. But come back to what you call the sly reversal of cause and effect. It's a good line. And you said Ta-Nehisi can speak for himself. He did speak for himself to me the other night. And he said, listen, get rid of the embedded racism in the system, in our thinking, but also in our institutions, and the cultural symptoms would be gone in a decade. Mm-hmm. I want your response and also Orlando Patterson's to that very general idea. If housing were truly desegregated and the job market too, we'd get over even the 20% of the disconnected trouble kids.
Well, so I don't know about that. I don't know about the time frame, but I think that there's a strong argument to be made that that would greatly alleviate the problems that we see. Whether we completely eliminate them, who knows? But the best example of that is this. When we look at the turn of the century American consternation about the immigrant populations, they echoed in many ways the kind of racial assumptions and prejudices that they made about that were being deployed against black people.
You're talking 1900.
Yes.
People were coming ashore.
Turn of the 20th century, right, exactly. And so what really had to happen was a movement to, quote-unquote, Americanize these people, but really find niches in American society in which they fit. And this happens in an accelerated fashion, especially after World War II. So it would seem it's absurd for us to have a conversation about criminality among Italian-Americans now. Just we wouldn't have that conversation. But a century ago, this was a very relevant social conversation. What happened between there? The GI Bill, the New Deal, the expansion of housing, the creation of FHA, all these things that were facilitated to turn those people into an actual middle class. And so I think that those things are really important. And now all those dynamics were curtailed by the way in which they were administered racially. So black people did not participate in, did not benefit from this kind of social engineering to create this middle class. And now we're looking at it going like, well, why are people so far behind? And that's like my critique also. Like now we have a conversation when we, to the extent that we're prepared to talk about kind of society having to change in some ways, we'll say we want to talk about class, not race. We should have class-based affirmative action. It's like, well, we had class-based affirmative action. It's called American history.
Orlando Patterson, what do you make of...
Yeah, I mean, what he refers to is what a very eminent political scientist, Ira Katznelson, in a wonderful book called Affirmative Action for Whites. That is, American history has a long record of this, the GI Bill and all the rest of it, and from which blacks were excluded. Similarly, the move to the suburb was very much a form of affirmative action for whites, highly subsidized, in which blacks were excluded. There's no doubt that we have this horrendous history, which institutionally persists in many ways. However, let me just say this, that one of the fears I have right now is that we may run the risk of overreacting here. There's what I call a 20% conundrum in American race relations, okay? And this is what I mean. All the evidence indicates that since the 60s, white American attitudes about race, about racial differences, about racial inferiority has changed quite radically from a situation in which the majority of whites generally believed that blacks were different, that were inferior and so on, to one in which all, not only the polls, but real sort of in-depth research indicates that the great majority of white Americans now, close to 80%, really believe in, reject those views and are not racist in any sense, in that sense. But what's also clear from all the evidence and opinion polls, but also natural experiments and so on, is that there's a hard core of 20% of whites who remain thoroughly racist. Now, here's the problem. Here's what I call the 20% problem.
Okay.
Blacks are only 13% of the population. Whites are about 74-75%. What this means is that for every black person, there are still two whites who are thoroughly racist. I mean,
do they get to meet them or not?
Yes, but here's the problem. Not only do you have this 2-to-1 problem, but in fact, it's precisely that 20% who are most often likely to be meeting blacks.
Interesting.
A lot of them become policemen, for example. So, and what's more, something else is happening. The very success of blacks in, you know, the growth of the black middle class, the importance of the blacks in the popular culture, in politics and so on, has meant real resentment and an intensification of racism in this 20%. So we have this dilemma. To the typical white person out there, I mean, he can genuinely say that, you know, I don't feel I'm a racist and all the friends I have are not racist and be telling the truth. But for the typical black person, especially the black person in the cities, he or she can also generally say that, you know, every time I turn around, I meet a white person, I meet a racist, especially the people I'm dealing with, I'm meeting the police and so on. That's a real conundrum. And and how you solve it is quite a dilemma, because in a sense, the people who, blacks, especially in a city, are meeting are precisely the ones who are most likely to be resenting blacks. And it's part of an institutional problem. But also, I think one has to be careful then in this situation not to generalize this experience, although it's hard to see
I do want you to speculate, Orlando, on the Ta-Nehisi point.
Yeah.
If you dealt with, you know, a handful of major institutional problems, including the war on drugs, including mass incarceration, how soon would those social symptoms of the fatherless home, of the isolated ghetto, dissolve?
This is where I disagree. Look, I mean, the problem is not just structural, it's partly cultural. I mean, so one of the points I make because there are several of us in this work, is that there's no such thing as a cultural explanation or problem. It's always an interaction between structural and social, cultural and socioeconomic issues. Let me give you an example. Let's go back to the single mom who may, in fact, be culturally completely on the ball in terms of how you bring up a kid. And we know there are lots of single mom who are culturally alert to, you know, reading to your kids and so on. And but it doesn't matter how culturally educated she is about bringing up her kids and how much she may want to. If she's working two minimum wage jobs, she won't have the time to do it. So here you have sort of interaction of structural and cultural factors. Solving one side of it won't necessarily lead to the other, because you also have a situation in which, you know, it may well be that among certain segments of the population, it's become almost normative now, having kids as a single parent. And I don't think that you can see it solely as a problem of employment, of solving the structural problem.
Okay.
I mean, that's just a fact.
Jelani Cobb.
Okay. So
speak to the 20% point.
There are lots of things to respond to. but first, you know, in order to make this argument, we'd have to say that this would fundamentally work differently for black people than it would for the white people who were the inhabitants of ghettos in the beginning of the 20th century.
Right.
And we've seen how social policy transformed those people into the good, hardworking Americans who are lionized and praised by politicians every time they take to the podium. That's one thing. Yeah. As per, you know, the 20% rule, we would be so lucky if white supremacy were confined to a mere 20% of the white population. But what we actually see, as a matter of fact, the Washington Post reported on this in 2012, was that polling showed that there was an uptick from 48% to 51% of whites who showed some latent anti-black attitudes. And when we look at implicit bias, those numbers are higher than that. But even if we took this 20% to be applicable, there's a difference between saying that 80% of the white population does not hold explicitly racist views of white people, or even implicitly racist views of white people, and saying that those people are also willing to commit themselves to the work of undoing the structural impediments that exist independent of their attitudes.
Well said.
Yeah, that well said. I mean, I wholly agree with that. I mean, one of the things which sociological work has shown is that racial attitudes is somewhat independent from willingness to do the sort of things necessary to make the changes. We are fully in agreement on that. We're talking about those sort of fundamental institutional changes which have to be made, such as, for example, the problem, what I see as one of the fundamental problems in this society is the persistence of segregation. We're as segregated now as we were in 1970. Our schools, if anything, are a little worse.
Yes, and right.
So, I mean, there's where this is kind of institutional problem I see as critical, because as long as the groups are living separately, we're going to have a persisting problem of misunderstanding, or worse.
I'm still puzzling about what kind of mind change it's going to take, and that's a sort of an institutional problem too, to rethink incarceration, rethink the war on drugs, to see what's happening in Attica today, what happened in Attica almost 50 years ago, and turn the page, turn back. Orlando Patterson is our guest. The Cultural Matrix is his book. Jelani Cobb joins us from Connecticut. Coming up, the hip-hop aesthetic across the cultural matrix, the black creative energy in the earbuds of white America, too. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source.
My mama was raised in the era when clean water was only served to the fairer skin. Doing clothes, you would have thought I had help, but they wasn't satisfied unless I picked the cotton myself. You
see, that is Kanye West singing New Slaves. It's a tiny sampling of the diversified genre known as hip-hop. In the lineage of jazz, blues, R&B, rock, and now for years, the dominant sound in commercial music. I asked Franny Kelly of NPR, co-host with Ali Shaheed Muhammad of the music show Microphone Check, to tell us what hip-hop is saying, where it's going, what it's reporting about race in real life.
I think it's saying it's time to start paying closer attention to what the kids are saying. This most recent generation of musicians seems to have a better grasp on how to talk to each other, how to sort of put aside some differences, and they're much more interested in classism than in racism per se. And I think that probably bodes well for the quality of the music. What happens is people look at hip-hop music, and it seems to be a safe place for people to criticize things like misogyny and homophobia and violence and materialism, things that are all a part of our culture every day. But we don't want to talk about them when these awful things are coming out of the mouths of, you know, our family members or people that we otherwise like, or even ourselves. People like to point at hip-hop and say, look, that's messed up. But we don't say, look, that's my boss doing that. That's messed up. Meanwhile, the DEA teamed up with the CCA. They try and lock against up. They try and make new state. See, that's that probably on prison. Get your peace today. They probably y'all in the Hamptons bragging about what they made.
Dig deeper into this whole misogyny rap about rap. How deep, how permanent? What's the trend?
It's not pretty. I think that the misogyny that appears in hip-hop appears in most productions of our culture. To be perfectly honest, when I'm spoken to about the misogyny in hip-hop and it is suggested to me that maybe I should listen to something else, I feel much more gendered and put in my place than I do when I actively listen to rap music of my own volition.
Franny Kelly, you say it is a culture. If this cultural sample came to you from another planet or from the other side of the earth, would you conclude, wow, these people are in trouble, or these people are coming back?
I think that the ways that hip-hop culture combines fighting back and getting down is evidence that people haven't given up. And I think that it means that these people are going to find a way to make play their job. That's stealing a line from a writer named Robin D.G. Kelly. No relation. And like, what better victory? What better way to win than to say, okay, you're gonna send all the jobs away from me. You're gonna take away mass transit so I can't get to these jobs anymore. You're gonna discriminate in my housing. You're gonna lock me up for the same offense you don't lock somebody up in the suburbs. I'm gonna do this. I'm gonna take this thing that I enjoy doing with my friends, and I'm gonna make enough money off of it to support my family. Bye.
I saw them shit black as slave, can be black. Boy, we feel one leap of pain, can be black. I'm an asset, they put me in a chain, can be black. I'm a chain now, me go a chain full of rocks. And you know, see the whip.
That was Franny Kelly at NPR. Our guests live are Orlando Patterson, the Harvard sociologist with traces of Jamaica in his voice, and Jelani Cobb of the University of Connecticut and the New Yorker magazine. Assume, both of you, please, that the people who write the songs are creating a record of the times, as poets and minstrels always do. What do you hear in that music, Jelani Cobb?
I think the hip-hop is so broad that,
of course,
it really can't be categorized in that way. I mean, there's some things that are incredibly insightful and incisive and progressive, and there's some things that are really retrograde and backward. And, you know, what hip-hop is more than anything is, you know, the contradictions that are all present in all of us as human beings, and just rendered in art. I don't think we can typify it in that way.
But just react to what you were hearing right there, a sample of an ocean of music. I mean, is this distress crying out, or some sort of more powerful survival urge, as Franny Kelly seemed to say?
You mean about Kanye West specifically?
Well, yeah. For starters.
Well, no, I don't know that. I mean, I think Kanye West is someone who comes from a really stable middle class background in Chicago.
His mama was a professor.
Right, his mother was a professor. I don't think that it has to be that. Like, in the same sense that not every rock song has to kind of tell, you know, the incisive critique of American culture. Or not every rock musician has to carry that burden. I think that it's permissible for someone to be a hedonistic, materialistic, emotionally complex, but sometimes emotionally shallow individual, just talking about how they perceive the world. And that's what I take from Kanye West.
Orlando Patterson, what do you hear?
Yeah, well, look, let me say two things about hip-hop. One myth, that they're the cause of the problems in the ghetto, the misogyny and the violence and so on. Mm. The evidence suggests that that's not so. I mean, there's a very simple way of demonstrating. At the height of the violence in the inner cities, I mean, in the 80s, for example, hip-hop was, in fact, very progressive, very conscious, what have you. Hip-hop, the genre, which became increasingly dominant, you know, the gangster rap and so on, which we think of when we think of the misogyny and what have you, came about at precisely the time when the crime and the violence was declining precipitously. Hmm. So, I mean, there's just from a sociological point of view, there's no reason to think that it's causing anything. It's largely expressive of a condition. But what fascinates me about hip-hop is the fact that this major audience is white. Okay?
Interesting point.
And white upper middle class and middle class. And I've been intrigued by that for a long time. What's going on in the minds and the souls and the behavior of white kids when they listen to hip-hop and, in fact, are the ones supporting and making Kanye a millionaire and Jay-Z? I think this has to do with the nature of a certain contradiction in American capitalist culture itself, which my late colleague Daniel Bell spoke about at great length. That is, it seems to me that we have this powerful culture which is highly disciplined and which is almost Apollonian in its requirements to conform and what have you. And there's always a need in every culture to counterbalance this with a Dionysian kind of impulse. And what white kids are getting out of it. And, you know, the kids who are going to the boardrooms and going to, you know, I mean...
Discipline.
Is this counterbalance. And, I mean, and so it's being used in this way. And it's a far more value, if you like, to white kids than it is the blacks. I mean, one of the things I'm concerned about is not so much... Well, I'm concerned about misogyny and all the rest of it. But the problem is that it sort of over-motivates. Okay, I mean, as Kitwana, who writes on this subject, said, I mean, every other black kid in the inner city thinks that he or she, he usually is going to be a rap, successful rap artist. And the fact that it's so accessible, doing it now, it emphasizes that. And that ain't going to happen. I mean, the chances of a successful hit is very remote.
So it's a kind of fantasy
and
music.
And my concern...
That's not a problem,
I wonder sometimes what effects this has on their motivation to do other things. I may be wrong, but, you know, I mean, this is just one... And it's a minor, not, it's a minor concern.
Well, I mean, it is. Okay. It is, but I mean... Just for argument's sake, though, I mean, because we've heard this from Michelle Obama, actually said something to this effect, you know, about kids who want to be rappers and athletes. And this is one of the things that she kind of criticized kind of black youth for. It's like, but every white kid is allowed to have a band in his garage and is not kind of subjected to the lens of cultural pathology. And at some normal point in development, they realize that they're not going to be, you know, the next, you know, whoever, Kurt Cobain or whoever it is they idolize. And they go on and figure something else out to do with their lives. And so I am a professor of history.
Yeah.
And I'm an essayist. I write for The New Yorker frequently. But I tell people all the time that the first things that I ever wrote were, as a young person, were raps. The first time I ever sat down with a paper, a pad and paper, and decided to write something, they were the raps I was writing for my nascent, then stalled, and moribund career as a young rapper.
Yeah, look, let's not use the language of pathology. I wasn't talking about pathology. I was just talking about motivation, and I didn't use that word. I mean, it's a minor concern.
What are the continuities here with the tradition of jazz and blues and R&B?
It was exactly the same. I mean, what I mentioned earlier, I mean, this sort of, if you go back to the 20s, you'll find, you know, the folks who were going down, the Harlem Renaissance and so on, were getting much the same thing out of jazz as the white kids are getting out of hip-hop now. It's Norman Mailer on the white Negro. And, you know, there's a long tradition. In fact, it goes back to the 19th century. And this extraordinary fascination on the part of the dominant society with black American culture. In a way, minstrelsy, as a lot of studies are now showing, was in many ways an obsession with black culture. But at the time, of course, they couldn't acknowledge it openly. So what you did was you mocked the creators in blackface while, in fact, you're appropriating and stealing the culture. I mean, this thing is ingrained in American society. That's one thing that fascinates me about the culture.
Is the alienation in rap different, larger, lesser than the alienation in jazz, Jelani?
I don't think so. I don't think so. I mean, I think these are the same kinds of, you know, kind of discussions. Even when we think about music that's now innocuous, like, you know, Cab Calloway's Minnie the Moocher, which people will kind of sing that song. Everyone hears it. It's the Heidi, Heidi, High song. Yeah. But that song is about a woman who's addicted to opium and resorts to prostitution to feed her habit. And so these kinds of things, these kinds of issues of alienation, you know, have been expressed in popular culture. Yeah. I mean, it's the same thing that the Beat Poets were talking about with their alienation from a different perspective in the 1950s.
I'm dying to ask you.
I don't think rap is alienation. I mean, I don't think rap is alien. I think rap is totally American. And in many ways, many of the values they're reflecting, as they themselves pointed out, come out of the dominant culture.
Yeah.
One of the fascinating things about black youth is that while they're socially segregated. They're culturally totally involved with the culture, partly because of their massive exposure to television and so on. But, you know, I don't see rap as alienation. I see it as expressing one dimension of the dominant culture.
It's both of those things simultaneously, because the people who produce those things are both alienated and deeply American. And so hip-hop's embrace of materialism is precisely the kind of American materialism that you would expect from
absolutely.
The people who've been birthed in a culture so steeped in, you know, kind of monetary gain and the outer accoutrement of success, but at the same time, people who've been denied it. And so it's both of those things at the same time. It's kind of a radical and angry critique at not being allowed to have access to things that may or may not be worth pursuit in the first place.
I'd like to ask both of you to look ahead. Orlando, I'm surprised. In your book and in conversations we've had about it, you say we're not, the culture is, even the racial relations are not in crisis. It's not particularly a time for a new conversation. Where would you be intervening in this rather difficult situation?
I'd be intervening in all the areas of institutional failure. I'd be intervening in the fact that America is a laggard on the welfare states, that, you know, all the other advanced countries are way ahead of us. And I think race has something to do with that. I'd intervene in getting the police to sort of, you know, I mean, behave like a police force should be, which is to protect the public rather than be an occupying force. I'd be very, very much involved in changing, you know, all the things which are essential, such as the problem of inequality.
We're going to talk again about how sociologists construct these changes.
Paying people a living wage. I mean, those are the fundamental institutional factors which I'd focus on.
Look ahead, Jelani Cobb. Where are we going?
I think that there are things that concern me, partly because, demographically speaking, you know, the kind of most significant upsurge we saw in racial reform happened at a point where the American economy was booming and well past the point at which there had been any significant immigration into the country. So both in terms of social standing and its kind of sense of identity, Americans were better primed to be liberal and reformist on matters of race than they have been since. When we look at the demographic changes now, the thing that concerns me is not so much this question about Black youth and culture and so on, but the really hard demographic realities of how people respond when white people are no longer the clear majority in the society. And that's something I think that will be much more informative in terms of how race plays itself out in the future.
Interesting point. We're feeling the pressure already, says I. I thank you both. Jelani Cobb in Connecticut, Orlando Patterson of The Cultural Matrix, and Franny Kelly of NPR. Get another angle on America from our friend Ganzir. He's the Egyptian street artist who has taken root in Brooklyn. He's now drawing his impressions not a dictatorship in Cairo, but of us, New York, the United States. His posters and our conversation are up on our website, radioopensource.org. Leave a comment about your own place, your own standing, your own views inside the cultural matrix. President Obama gets the last word on our program this week from Selma. He's talking about all of us.
We are storytellers, writers, poets, artists who abhor unfairness and despise hypocrisy and give voice to the voiceless and tell truths that need to be told. We're the inventors of gospel and jazz and blues, bluegrass and country and hip-hop and rock and roll and our very own sound with all the sweet sorrow and reckless joy of freedom. We are Jackie Robinson, enduring scorn and spike cleats and pitches coming straight to his head and stealing home in the World Series anyway. We are the people Langston Hughes wrote of who build our temples for tomorrow, strong as we know how. We are the people Emerson wrote of
who for truth and honor's sake stand fast and suffer long, who are never tired so long as we can see far enough. That's what America is.
Our show was produced by Max Larkin, Connor Gillies, and Pat Tomeno, with help from Rebecca Panovka. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time for Open Source.